There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen, and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Good evening and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Well, we're halfway through the week, man.
Yeah,
we made it halfway through.
Yep.
We've got a great show lined up for you. Timothy P. Smith is going to join us in a few moments. The Chamberlain Key, unlocking the God Code to reveal divine messages hidden in the Bible. We'll talk about that in a few moments. Today's show is brought to you by the good folks at Casper Beds. That's a bed I use. Now, Tim is getting one. He'll be able to tell you a little bit about that later on. But if you're interested in buying a bed and you want to save $50 towards any mattress purchase, just check out CasperTrial.com/darkness to save $50 off. Again, that's Casper, CasperTrial.com/darkness to save $50 off your purchase. And today's show is also brought to you by HelloFresh, where you can save $35 off your first week of deliveries. Visit HelloFresh.com and enter code darkness when you subscribe to start your savings. This week is unfolding quickly for us. Ursula Bialski will be here, a good friend from Chicago, author, tour guide, and host of the Chicago Paracon. We'll both be out there later on this year.
Yep.
She'll be discussing her book, The Ghost in You, Poltergeist, Electrokinesis, and Phantasms of the Living, plus a brand new theater of the mind. Thursday, Tim, we're going to take a little trip through time.
Really?
Yeah. Andrew Bashago is back, our favorite time-traveling political opponent. He's going to run again in 2020. For president, but I mentioned he's got some really interesting stuff and some people that have come forward now. We're going to be talking with him and them regarding Project Pegasus and the time travel program.
And can we ask him what happened with this last campaign?
Well, he already said when he was on, he didn't expect to win this first
round.
But he expected Donald Trump to win, which would then open up the possibilities in the future for truthers and people to come forward. So I think that'll kind of be the play that we'll get on that one.
All right.
But he's got an interesting play on this. And if he's got people coming forward now substantiating his claims.
Okay.
So it's going to be intriguing. But tonight, Tim, tonight we're going to discuss the book, The Chamberlain Key. Timothy B. P. Smith, I should say. Timothy B. Smith is not our guest tonight, Timothy P. Smith is. And in 1998, Timothy discovered the Chamberlain Key. He's here to talk to us about this. He's currently working with the History Channel to create a documentary that will focus on the search for hidden biblical treasures in Europe and the Middle East. The program is scheduled for broadcast in the fall of 2017. His book comes out today. So you guys are among the first to hear about it and among the first to be able to order it. So we'll have a link up for that. Welcome to the show, Timothy Smith.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, Timothy. Let's get a little bit of background on you. Talk to me a little bit about what drove you into this vein of research. This is something definitely intriguing, but not something that everybody thinks about. Where did you come from to get to this point?
Okay. Well, yeah, it's always good to give some, background sort of what's in my wheelhouse. By profession, I am a conservator and appraiser of fine art and antiquities, ancient manuscripts, ancient artifacts, all kinds of fine art. I have a specialty in ancient and aboriginal ceremonial devices, mnemonic devices. Those are things that are used in ancient ceremonies. And when we say mnemonic, we just mean that they're usually some of these devices have a lot of iconography and symbolism on them that help people or usually remind the people officiating in ceremonies, coronation ceremonies, things like that, reminds them what the meaning and the history of the device is for, whether it be a scepter, a crown, a throne, a robe, and it's usually very similar in a lot of cultures. My grandfather came to Washington in the 1930s to build the Jefferson Memorial. He built the National Museum of Art, restored the U.S. Capitol. My father also was in the same line of work. His first big project was to convert the Naval Observatory into the residence for the vice president. And then I started a fine art and antiquities conservation and restoration business in McLean, Virginia, really Langley, Virginia, right outside of Washington, in the early 1980s. Been at it ever since. We also, as part of a business, and it's at the times it's a very, very large business, we also hunt down for agencies and governments stolen artifacts. And so that's my background, how I got into all this.
Well, now, hold on. You're just going to roll over this like it's, yeah, sometimes I flip burgers on Friday and milkshakes on Saturday. You're right. Reclaiming stolen artifacts for the governments, and this is an amazing job. How do you get into this line of work? I mean, were you intrigued by the Indiana Jones movies? What got you following this?
Well, no, I mean, it's all on a professional line. And once you become, when it comes to, you know, part of the appraisal business, especially, and I'm certified with the Internal Revenue and I'm certified with insurance companies, and one thing leads to another. When you're doing the appraisal of items, like when something is stolen, whether from a government agency, from the White House, we've tracked down things stolen from the White House, the appraisers come in, because the first thing that has to happen is for the insurance companies, the value of that has to be established the first thing. And then amongst appraisers worldwide and people involved in antiquities, there's, you know, we become aware of the black market. Things are sold on the black market. There's a lot of data analytics used to track down these things. We work with the FBI, the Holocaust Reparations Groups. And so there's a network, and part of my – these are family businesses, and part of – members of my family are in law enforcement, and both at the federal level and, you know, others. And so, you know, this is all part and parcel of kind of the high-end international antiquities trade.
That sounds amazing. What a fascinating life. I mean, to track down – first of all, I got to know, just taking you off key for a second here, how does something get stolen from the White House? There's not security. I mean, they don't notice the giant lump in Hillary's bag as she's walking out. Okay. What's going on?
Well, that's another story. usually it's something goes missing. We don't call it stolen. Okay. We always refer to it as gone missing, mm-hmm. because sometimes it could be a government official, a very high up government official who may have inadvertently given the item as a gift to somebody, a Senate aide, a White House aide, or someone who helped them in their campaign or something, and they didn't think it was, maybe in their opinion, it wasn't government property or had been hanging around so long. I mean, I don't really want to go into that.
Right.
I don't. You know, we've been involved in a number of these things, and it's not my job to I'm not the police. Once we locate the item, we try to, as discreetly as possible, gain possession of it and maybe encourage the person to make a donation of the item to the appropriate institution where the government wants to have it housed and protected anyway. So and the police, it's a last resort. We always try to gain possession and not to make accusations. If you make accusations, everybody goes and lawyers up.
Right.
We don't want people lawyering up, because right. then it just gets held up in court forever.
Right. So it's, hey, we understand this happens from time to time. Mr. Reagan was simply just being a little too gregarious when he gave you the china from Thomas Jefferson. And we kind of need that back for the museum. So it's more of that kind of just play on, mistakes happen, right?
Right. And sometimes you can even arrange a very good, if the person has, remember, possession is 9/10 of the law. If the right. person has possession of it, you may even be able to arrange a very nice donation and tax write-off for them.
Wow.
Everyone's happy. Everybody wins. Everybody wins. The government's happy. Gets back. The person's happy. I'm happy. And the right thing has been done. It gets a little more tricky on the black market when you're talking about artifacts that have been stolen in Iraq, Syria, that gets dangerous.
Well, yeah, I would guess so. And trying to track these things down. I mean, do you have a pretty good through all of your law enforcement connections? I mean, are there just informants who live to try to tell people where things are and how they're popping up on the market?
There's a network for these things. I mean, the FBI has a database of stolen antiquities, the Holocaust reparations. And you have to remember, we're still tracking down things that were stolen or taken possession of by the Nazis during World War II. So, and these things turn up when the reason I come in contact with it a lot is because I do estate appraisals during probate when things are being inherited. And so things will pop up that people have inherited, and the children or the grandchildren often have no idea where the item came from. It was brought back from Europe after World War II. And so they don't know, but I may recognize that, you know, they have a great master's painting or something, and they're like, oh, let's sell this for, you know, can you, because we also broker these estates for people, and they want to sell it. And we go, wait a second, we have to run this by certain databases to make sure it wasn't reported stolen during World War II in Europe.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. What a life. That is something pretty cool. Tim, don't you feel like we've really squandered our lives now that we just basically worry about fantasy football and, you know, if McRib is coming back this week or not?
I really am a slug on a rock when you put it that way.
This guy's out trying to get antiquities back from World War II and stolen presidential presents. And
I'm just trying to find my Walter Payton rookie card somewhere in the basement.
But now I know the guy to call, Tim, when I can't find the remote control.
Yeah.
Timothy Smith is my guy.
Nice. I'm on it. I'm your guy.
I like the sound of it. All right. The book is out today, The Chamberlain Key.
All right.
Let's start off with this, Timothy. What is the Chamberlain Key?
Well, this all started with in the early 1980s when I was trying to unravel a mystery concerning my mother's ancestry. I was raised Roman Catholic. I was told that my grandparents came from Italy in between World War I and World War II. As I became older, you know, in my early 20s, you know, and again, I was already started in the beginning of starting, you know, a business where we did a huge amount of research. I understood, you know, I was a genealogist, a historian. It's all part and parcel of that kind of trade, of the antiquities trade. And there were funny things concerning that didn't make sense about them being Italian. And so, to make a long story short there, I discovered that they were actually Sephardic Jewish from their family lines from Italy and Spain. And so one thing led to another. I started to have some actually very unusual personal spiritual experiences, you could say paranormal experiences, supernatural experiences, you know, all that's semantics. It's a matter of how you want to describe it. And I started on a private level, keeping it all very private. In my business, it's not a real good thing to talk about experiences like that because you market yourself as a serious conservator, appraiser, and talking about your, you know, a paranormal experience or a supernatural experience doesn't go real well in my kind of business. So I kept it private, but I was still tracking it down because.
You're among friends now, though, Timothy. So feel free to regale us. Right.
Right. That's why I agreed to do this interview.
Excellent.
Because I said, this will be great. So. Well,
can you give us a little taste of what type of yes. activities were taking place?
Okay, so the first thing that happened was in 3 years in a row on January 12th, 1986, 1987, and 1988. On January 12th, I had the same dream. And it was a very powerful dream. I mean, a dream that, you know, you wake up in a cold sweat out of bed. It was the same dream. There was the basic part of the dream was that there was this just overwhelming, terrifying storm on the horizon coming my way, no matter where I was at the time, where I was, you know, living or whatever. And it was afterwards, a few months after the third dream in the series, I had a dream that pinpointed a specific location in the Canadian Rockies in British Columbia. It gave me the longitude and the latitude. This is all in the book, and I want too many spoilers. If I back off a little, it's because, gee, I don't want to give too many spoilers for the book because this is in the book. So long story short, and I was, my business was going very good at the time, but I just knew, and this is always hard for people to explain when they feel overwhelmingly impressed to do something, go somewhere, to talk to someone. It's hard to explain why you just are, you know, you cannot resist to do it. You feel if you don't do it, you'll miss out on some kind of guidance, some kind of discovery, don't know. But I was so overwhelmed with the impression that I needed to go to this spot. Took my young fam, dropped the business, you know, for a while, you know, drove all the way across from Virginia. So this is in the Washington area, all the way across the country to the howling wilderness of the Rockies, of way close to the Northwest Territories in British Columbia. All I knew was the location, and I had a longitude and latitude, and I went there. And then an absolutely overwhelming experience occurred there after we were there for a few months. And that experience just set the course of the rest of my life and eventually led into the most mind-boggling discoveries probably in the modern age. Some people are calling them kind of the holy grail of the intersection between the supernatural and empirical science, because these experiences, unlike some people have very subjective experiences that can't really be verified and independently analyzed by scientists and other things. This is the unusual case where the discovery it led to, is being and has been analyzed by, you know, physicists, astrophysicists, people in the defense intelligence industry. Of course, the scrutiny that it came under for Random House, the publishing companies, the production companies doing the documentary, so they didn't want to embarrass themselves. And of course, as you see, the foreword to my book is written by probably the most prominent ancient language linguist in the world, Dr. Eugene Ulrich, who was the chief translator of the biblical text of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the one person in the world everyone trusted to translate the biblical text of the Dead Sea Scrolls, because there's more than just biblical text in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So he's spent a long career at Notre Dame and is now retired and a friend of mine.
That's pretty cool. Man, I can understand why that would inspire you to want to get involved in doing this kind of thing. I mean, do you feel that's kind of a gift that you've been given, that you have these insights, for lack of a better term?
Again, here's the words. Call it a gift. And I never considered myself to actually, like, I don't consider myself clairvoyant or anything like that, because I have absolutely zero control of these things. I have, it's not like something I can ever turn on or off things. And I think, you know, I was very shy to talk about these things, but when I do, since I've opened up, you find that more people have these experiences themselves and are afraid to talk about them. But I think people know when it's different. We all have dreams. We all dream things every night, every other night, whatever. And I think we know the difference between just a casual dream that's, you know, a bit of which you haven't digested the day before, or even something that's a dream from stress or from because you have your mind on something. And when something's coming from the outside, you know it's not coming from your own consciousness. It's not anything you know about. It's not anything you've been thinking about. It's not, and you are, and when it's a communication, intelligent communication from some other source, you know it when you experience it. You can tell the difference. And I think most people can when that's happening.
Right. Yeah, you get that definite sense that there's a break in that normalcy of what a dream or a thought is like. It's more vivid, more clear, and especially when it's pointing you to something that then you can go find and corroborate your vision, for lack of a better, you know, my mind is all jumbled up here trying to think of 1,000 things with this. But yeah, you've got the corroboration, which is really amazing to get into this kind of stuff.
The discoveries here, what we're talking about, to make this kind of clear. So the discoveries that everyone has been able to analyze, scrutinize, run under, statistical analytics and everything, are discoveries in the oldest manuscripts of the Hebrew Old Testament, particularly, and it began with the discovery in the book of Genesis. And again, this is the oldest manuscripts of the book of Genesis, the Leningrad Codex, and the received text, Jerusalem Bible, about 1,000 years old, the extant manuscripts, transcribes from manuscripts probably is, several hundred years B.C.,
Wow. All right. You've got this calling to start researching and looking into these things.
Right.
What would bring you to the point of looking for encrypted codes when you're reading these texts and looking for it? I mean, why not just,
right.
I mean, most of us would read it and assume that this is what they're telling us. This is the story.
Right. Okay. Well,
yeah.
So what specifically occurred was that I was on, I had actually sold one of my businesses in the McLean, the main business in McLean, in 1996, and moved to Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. And we had an auction gallery there, and again, appraisal business. I signed a non-compete agreement, so I had to go out of the Washington area, that part of the East Coast. So, I take a sip of water here. And so at the time, I had, right at the moment when I finally, my daughter was born. Before that, I was the father of six sons. I had six sons. And finally, in 1997, my daughter was born. So I had six sons and a daughter. And right, I remember calling my parents up and telling them, oh, can't believe it. We finally had a daughter. And it hit me like a ton of bricks that my father also had six sons and a daughter. It's not like I hadn't thought about it before. It's just that I reminded, oh, my gosh, my dad also has six sons and a daughter. I have six sons and a daughter. And because of my experience in British Columbia, now back to the experience in British Columbia, which was in 1989, I had an experience where it was a flat-out visitation. It was not a dream. I was wide awake, and the personage. I was in a cabin in the Howling Wilderness, and into the room that I was in at the time, I was just completely, like all I can say is attacked by any number of. I could only say unembodied personages that just hated me. I've heard other people talk about experience like that where they feel like some kind of a spiritual attack.
Right.
This is how it started. And I also had a sense that these entities, whatever they were, hated humans. It's very hard to explain, but there was just this hatred for me and hatred for all of just humans, like they hated humans. Can't explain it. And I called out, and I was I wouldn't say a religious person, but I certainly I knew it was almost intuitively, I knew the one name that I could call out to in the face of such a thing, because I was pressed down to the bed. I could hardly breathe. I could hardly move. I couldn't hardly talk. And I had to actually struggle to do it. And I called out in the name of Jesus Christ. And immediately when I did that, a pillar or a conduit of light came down into the room that I was in, into the cabin, and the conduit of light came in first, and then into that conduit came a personage, a man, who I immediately understood to be Moses, the lawgiver, kind of the last person, that's not who I called out for help for, so I had no idea why. And then the person handed me something, it was actually a piece of linen rolled up in a cylinder shape, about 12 inches, maybe 16 inches long, and about probably, 5 inches in diameter. And it was a rolled up cylinder, looked like a scroll, and it was tied. And then he bade me, and this was, the communication was all telepathic. He bade me to unravel it, to untie it. And I did. I untied it. The contents of it spilled into my lap. And then And then it continued, the experience continued, and I experienced, I was taken through a type of ceremony. And in this particular situation, I was very familiar with ancient ceremonies. So it meant this part I actually understood to a certain extent. And it was similar to ancient ceremonies that I had heard about and read about and had been studying for some time. But there were elements of it that were completely foreign to me, that I had never seen or heard anything like it. I was also other beings, you call them heavenly beings. Two women actually were involved in taking me through the ceremony. And I won't go again into any more. I don't want to spoil anything from the book. So the reason I was looking in the earliest, why I was very curious in the oldest Hebrew manuscripts, was because I had this experience, I was trying to figure out what it all meant. What was I supposed to do? And because I felt guided to go there in the first place. And so I had my radar up for anything associated with the earliest, the Torah, the Torah of Moses, the lawgiver. And so right in 1997, at the same time when my daughter was born, for the first time in history, they published a high-quality facsimile edition of the oldest complete manuscript of the Hebrew Old Testament called the Leningrad Codex. And it's held under high security at the National Russian Library in St. Petersburg. And for the first time after the fall of the Berlin Wall and everything, the Russians allowed a group to take a high-resolution photographic facsimile of it, and they became available. And I borrowed one of these through the interlibrary loan system when I was on Martha's Vineyard. Came from the University of Virginia. And so it was for the first time in my life I had my hands on the very oldest sections of the Torah in facsimile edition. So these were photographs of the document itself, which is over 1,000 years old.
Now, can I ask you a question, Timothy, at the risk of sounding ignorant myself? I grew up Christian, Lutheran background. Right. Mm-hmm. King James Bible kind of was our staple growing up.
Right.
When we talk about the Torah, now, my understanding, and please correct me when I'm wrong here, is that the Torah is basically the Old Testament and they don't include the New Testament?
No.
No?
The Torah
okay.
is... No, the Torah is just the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Okay, so what we call the Old Testament, they call the Tanakh, which includes the prophets and the writings. So you have, including Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, all the prophets, and also the writings, Chronicles, Kings, et cetera,
Song of Solomon, so, right, the whole batch. All right,
right,
so you've got
right. –
so in the Torah, it's the five first books. When you're
right.
looking
but
at
this,
these – when you're looking at this and you compare it to I don't want to say current day, because I know there's a lot of modernization of the Bible now that they're trying to make it hipper and easier to read,
right?
Which I'm sure will eventually include LOLs in the Bible. But when you look at the original Torah compared to what most of us grew up with of the Bible of the last 30 to 50 years, how radically different?
Well, first of all, you're looking at Hebrew,
right? I understand that, but it's still a narrative. It's still telling a story. How I'm just
yes,
wondering
correct.
From what everybody right. always talks about is the fact how these stories are manipulated by whatever leader, King James or whatever, wanted
right,
to
by
change
the translation.
By the translation. How
right.
radically different are the five books of the original Torah compared to what we know of the first five books of the Bible?
Well, that's a very good question, because this is what the discoveries are really finally helping us to understand. Mm-hmm. So a translation is by very nature an interpretation. Whenever you translate anything, you're rendering an interpretation to try to take what you believe is the meaning of the original text and trying to render that meaning into another language. And to do so, you have to make an interpretation. Hebrew syntax is nothing like English syntax. In other words, the words aren't in the same order. If you would see a literal translation word by word of let's say of a verse in the Hebrew, it doesn't come out the same way. So there's that process. However, for instance, the King James Bible of the Old Testament is a pretty good translation of the meaning of the overtext of the oldest Hebrew Tanakh, because it's been scrutinized. I'll put it this way: it's the very best that modern and classical scholarship has been able to do, and there's a pretty good general agreement by scholars and academics and linguistic scientists about what is the general meaning. However, they admit, and we all know, that there is so much more to it. For instance, the early in the Middle Ages, you know, the Torah scholars and Hebrew scholars bluntly said that there was nearly an infinite amount of information that was encrypted into the Torah and into these biblical records using forms of complex data compaction. This was an open thing that they would say. Everyone thought that, oh, they're just bragging about their ancestral book. But in fact, part of the discovery we have made is that is absolutely correct, that the ancient Hebrews had access to or were using a form of data compaction that can only be compared to quantum computing or writing a quantum computer program. And finally, for the first time, we have the technical capability to start to unravel these things. And we're not talking about overly simplistic things like the Bible code or things like that. Although there, you know, probably, you know, in the late 1990s, some of these things started to, you know, there was some Israeli scientists who started to discover some strange anomalies in the text. There was also engineers and physicists who had started to in Israel, who started to, from another angle, also see some strange anomalies. Things started to.
Can I ask you a question then, Timothy?
Sure.
For those of us that have a faith in a religion, all right, based on the Bible, the Torah,
right?
Does this, boy, you know, when you start talking religion, it's a thin line you start skating without pissing off the world.
Go ahead. No, I know what you're going to ask.
Here's the question. All right. So if we're realizing that there were hidden codex in these Torah and throughout the Bible, does that then render what is actually shared in the Bible as useless? Was it more of a way to hide
exactly opposite
text? Okay.
Nope. Exact opposite, because the real encryptions, the real information that was inlaid into the overtext, into the stories, is perfectly synchronized with those, with that narrative. It complements that narrative. It's thematically,
Well, then why the redundancy if it's just going to corroborate what it's already written?
It's not redundant. No, it adds additional information. It does not. It's the same way. With your computer, you open up your computer. You have a file. You open up maybe a file that then gives you the general idea of what's in something, and then you have a bunch of files inside the file. You can open up each one of those, and you have it. It just adds more information. It's not redundant at all. For instance, you have. And again, this is the way ancient communication was. This is the way the ability to compact information. They didn't have computers.
Right. This sounds so like the Little Orphan Annie decoder ring. Drink more Ovaltine. Is that what the Bible is really telling us then? But I'm just saying you've got this narrative, but then there's a subtext to the narrative that gives more. Why? I guess here would be the important part. Why? Mm-hmm. Why make it so complex? If this is truly the word of God, why not just lay it out? You know, it's kind of like when I talk to mediums and psychics. All of the messages seem intertwined in kind of this unnecessary BS. Listen, just get to the message. He's showing me flowers. He's showing me Mickey Mouse ears. Just tell me, hey, remember the time we went to Disneyland? I mean, that kind of thing. Why not just make it a clear, understandable narrative? Why did there have to be all these layers to what the story tells?
Okay. Well, first of all, you know, the first question up is who's doing the communication here. Mm-hmm. So one comparison you could give is that we've had DNA. Our DNA sequencing has been in our blood since the time we first, you know, showed up on the planet.
Right.
The fact that we have not been able to decipher or read that DNA until now does not does not indicate that it was never there. In other words, just because we couldn't read it, but you're almost answering your own question. In other words, that perhaps because, and again, we talk about this in the book, the messages seem to be time-locked. They're time-locked messages to be, in other words, in the same, when mankind has the ability to unravel them and decipher them, is the time when they really need them. In other words, the specific messages. But
on that sense, Timothy, and I don't mean to interrupt you, and I know I'm pissing off listeners, but I'll get lost in all of the massive amounts of information you're giving me if I don't ask now. If that's the case, when we're ready and we have the technology to break this code, then we'll get that message. Well, in that sense, we've always had the ability to read that code, because if we had the ability to create the code, we should have always had the ability to understand the code. So
no, we didn't have the ability to create the code. It wasn't, the code was not created by mortal men. It's the nature of what we have shown, what we've demonstrated, is we are getting communication from another dimension. This is real contact.
So what you're saying? Okay, so what you're saying is, in essence, I'm dictating to Tim my story. Tim types it up just hearing my story, not realizing that I, the grand and great Wizard of Oz, am actually putting a whole nother subtext into this. And when it's time, that story will be revealed. So that's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yeah. According to the tradition, Moses received the Torah on Mount Sinai from God.
Right.
Okay. That's the story. And he was given it in its letter sequence. He was just given a letter sequence. The earliest text and examples that we have of the Paleo Hebrew do not have any spaces. They do not have any finals. That you're just looking at one long letter sequence. It was given as a letter sequence. Everything else that we see in it is an imposition that was imposed upon it later. So it was given as that. It's been and then, you know, mankind has had the ability. So the first thing that the codes of, as we've deciphered them, is they identify who is the person communicating. This is communication from another dimension. So the first thing that happens is the communicator identifies themselves. And the reason it's called the Chamberlain key is because what we discovered actually was the key code that unlocks the rest of the text.
Oh.
And so, in other words, that's what it is. And there was a lot of discussion with publishers and everything. How much of this information would we lay out? The book is very simple and straightforward. It lays it out very easy. It's just a 250-page book. Started out 900 pages. It was redacted down to 250. And it's very easy to understand. Gives the backstory. And it gives that initial message. It lets you know who is doing the communicating, and the original message is mind-blowing.
All right, we need to take a quick break. This is fascinating. The Chamberlain Key, Unlocking the God Code to Reveal Divine Messages Hidden in the Bible. That's the book. It's out today. We'll be back. We've got more when we return with Timothy P. Smith and the Chamberlain Key next on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is Beyond the Darkness, your home for the best in paranormal talk radio 5 days a week here on Podcast One. And I got to tell you, folks, part of my life is trying to get enough sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a lot of trouble with that over the last couple of years. I finally ousted my expensive mattress that I got a couple of years back from a certain mattress store,
mm-hmm.
Because I wasn't sleeping well. This thing had all the guarantees and promises in the world on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it fell apart for me very quickly. Dips in the bed, uncomfortable, just not what I hoped for. Because again, it's really hard, Tim, when you go to a store and you lay down on the mattress for 2-3 minutes to get a feel for how that mattress is going to be a year down the road.
Absolutely.
6 months down the road, yeah. 4 years down the road. And I've only had my bed, I think, for 6 years. That's it.
That's it?
And it's been uncomfortable for the last couple of years.
Huh.
So I made a big different change for myself. I got in touch with Casper, because first of all, we're a paranormal show.
Yeah.
And anything with Casper in the title has to be good, right?
Gotta love it.
I did some research, checked it out, And I gave it a shot. I said, I'm going to give this thing a shot. And looked great, looked very comfortable. And they've got all the information and videos and everything right on their website so you can see what's going on. And I've fallen in love with it. I sleep so much better now. I'm getting full nights of sleep. I've gone from fitful nights of rolling and flipping and flopping to full nights of sleep with very little interruption, I should say, unless it's one of my kids coming in.
Yeah.
But the bed is not keeping me awake anymore, which I can't say has been the story for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a Casper mattress, and I got Tim now. He's ordered one. It's due in a week?
Yeah.
Week or so?
Yep.
And we both have California King beds. Now, here's the kicker. When you were doing some shopping, you were telling me California King beds were in the range of about $1,500 to $2,000
for a
decent one.
Yep.
Right? You start getting into the higher quality.
Yep.
And you're priced out of the market. Who can afford that? It's like buying a new car.
Right.
But when you want to get a good deal on a bed, going through Casper is the way to do it. And check it out. This is what they've got going on. It's an obsessively engineered mattress. And these are really shockingly fair prices. Just the right sink, just the right bounce on them. Two technologies used, latex foam and memory foam. And they come together, and I promise you're going to have a great night of sleep on these. Plus, there's a risk-free trial and return policy. So you try sleeping on a Casper for 100 days. That's 100 days, Tim. You don't get 4 minutes in a showroom to try it out.
Right.
You get 100 days in your home, and it's free shipping. And it's easy and painless returns. The Casper is now the most awarded mattress of the decade. Let that sink in. The most awarded mattress of the decade. And what do you average? It's like around $500 for a twin size mattress on Casper. And it was only $950 for a California king sized mattress. Comparing that again to industry averages out there, you're going to see this is an outstanding price for an amazing high quality bed. And this is what we've got for you. All right. I paid $950. You paid $950. Had you just waited, Tim?
Yeah.
Waited for me to tell you about this on the show?
Okay.
I could have saved you $50.
Really?
Yeah. You get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.caspertrial.com. CASPERTRIAL.com/darkness. And then use the promo code 50SLEEP. All one word, 50 sleep, means you're getting $50 towards any mattress purchase. Terms and conditions, of course, always apply. But go get that and get this bed and get a good resting night sleep, because I promise you're going to feel great. I do. My back doesn't hurt. My neck doesn't hurt. I'm feeling better, more refreshed, and fully awake when I wake up in the morning, which is a fantastic change for me. And I'm hoping it's going to be for you as well, Tim. So once you get the bed in, let me know how your nights are going.
I will.
All right. Very cool. Now let's get into the Chamberlain Key. Timothy P. Smith is our guest, and his book is out, available today. Timothy, I have to ask you one thing. When you were kind of getting these visions of, and digging into this, and you were sensing that there were things that were not happy with humanity or you digging into this, didn't that kind of unnerve you, that if you're having that powerful of a vision and that powerful of a message given to you, did you worry that things might start going horribly awry for you in your life by digging in to find these codes?
Well, you know, in some ways things, personally, mostly, I think what you're concerned about is that people are going to think you're crazy. I think that's right off the bat when it comes to your real life and dealing with your family and things like that. You're worried about the – and so you have to remember that I kept, for the most part, I kept a lot of it very, very private, mm-hmm. until I could explore it. I wanted to explore it privately. But, you know, yes, talking about it, whenever I would talk about it, it would you would get that. You would get that from people, no matter how much they trusted you or, whatever, is that it just seems crazy. It's foreign to people. It's alien to people. So you try to be circumspect with it.
I know that you found through this research hidden clues to things like the location of the contents in the Ark of the Covenant. Does that mean that the contents and the Ark have been separated?
A good question. As a matter of fact, the first one of the things that, the first message that the key code, the first message that we uncovered was a remarkable description of, this is in the book of Genesis, mind you. Okay. So in the Old Testament, in the oldest book of Jesus, the Messiah, mm-hmm. about his life, his his virgin birth, his ministry, his crucifixion, his trial, and his resurrection, and the purpose of it all. That was actually what was in the key code. When you were asking before about, you know, what's the purpose of this? Okay, this is in a manuscript, you know, so we learn that this book that the Jewish people, the Torah, have been protecting, they're called the people of the book, all along. And you wonder why are these things here? You may have been raised a Christian and you may have those beliefs, but there's millions and millions of people throughout the world that aren't. Now, this is coming forward as a supernatural event, testifying to testifying to that fact in an easy way that people can understand concerning that. The next thing that
Hold on one second. So in the book, the Torah, in the very first book of the Bible, they've already given spoilers away of how this thing wraps up. But more importantly, I thought the people of the Jewish faith do not believe that Jesus Christ was the Messiah, was not
but yet
it was already hidden in their writings that he was?
Yes, absolutely. And it's crystal clear. It's absolutely crystal clear. It gives precise details of everything about, and it synchronizes with the New Testament and the Gospels.
All right. Again, sitting on the outside looking in, if the whole idea behind Christianity is the way to God and the way to heaven is through Jesus Christ, right? But yet the people that wrote the Torah, the people that taught the Torah, didn't teach that Christ is the way to God. So,
right. Well, they didn't write. The people that teach the Torah are not the people that wrote the Torah.
Okay.
Right. All right. In other words, the whole point of this too, and the major part of the discovery is that this thing had to have been produced and written by a supernatural source. The Jews, of course, have been protecting it and preserving it.
That seem, in a sense, kind of a screw you to the Jews that, oh, here's the book, you guys protect it and watch over it, but we're not going to give you the most important part, which is if you don't believe in Jesus, you're not making it to heaven. That's kind of like Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you've only got the front side of the medallion and the back side is held from you. I mean,
Jesus was a Jew. All the disciples were Jews. Mm-hmm. All the first followers were Jews. Mm-hmm. And so you have to remember that Christianity is just a sect of Judaism. Mm-hmm. You know, always was considered a sect of Judaism until it became in the fourth century became the religion of Imperial Rome. Before then, it was just considered by others and by the Roman Empire to just be just another sect of Judaism. So.
But that would leave you thinking then that if that was the way it is, and that, you know, Christianity caught up with the idea that we have to believe in Jesus in order to get to the next level of this video game of life and afterlife, did that leave all of the Jews that came before this code being broken? Does that leave them in limbo because they didn't believe because that's not what they were taught?
Boy, that's a theological
question. Right, but that's what I'm saying. That's where it seems like this kind of code is shocking.
Right. Well, again, when you know things get discovered. For instance, there were lots of discoveries made when they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Right.
They've discovered other books, possibly written during biblical times that aren't included in the canon. All throughout the history of, for the last 2,000 years, 2,500 years, there have been new discoveries, and people have had to deal with the ramifications of those discoveries as they've been unfolded. Again, there's everything new about this, but then again, there's nothing new. What it means to any individual person. When Jesus came along and he taught what he taught to the people, and some people believed him and some people did not. Some people embraced it and some people did not. And he backed up what he said by miraculous occurrences and by the ultimate, miracle of resurrecting from the dead after 3 days of being dead. And so was it fair that he did this and he brought this message at that time to all the people for the previous 1,000 years of Jewish history that didn't understand it? Some people did understand it, and they understood that what he was teaching did synchronize with what they had all along. So you're really getting into, people's opinions about these things.
I think this is what makes religion so confusing for people. Again, this brings it up to what we were talking about earlier. I understand it's a faith-based system, and sometimes you have to just believe in what you can't put your hands on. You can't see it, sniff it, taste it, and it just has to be a belief. But then when you find out that there's like I hate to use the word tricks, but in a sense, there's kind of tricks to this whole thing. There's the story, and then there's the story inside the story. And not a lot of people are educated enough to catch up to that aspect of it.
Right. Well, I mean,
it takes 2017 years for Timothy P. Smith to crack this code and make it available to people. You know, that doesn't say much for ourselves as humanity, does it? No offense to you. I just mean the rest of us.
Sure. Well, it's just one of those things that you need to take a look at and make and decide what you think about it. I mean, like anything else, what I'm just doing is I am just laying these things on the table, putting them on the table for other people, and I completely opened it up for criticism, analysis, questioning. You know, there's a website, you know, thechamberlainkey.com, where there's many other articles that give more insight and stuff to these sorts of things. And the purpose of this first book is to just get this information out there so that people can do just like you're doing right now, to poke at it, to question it, to, you know, if they're uncomfortable with this part. And it starts the interchange. It's been so exciting so far with the comments that have, you know, come in from the galley copies, you know, advanced copies that went out, from graduate students, from people in fact, there's a group called AncientTextsResearch.org who went ahead and wrote a really high-powered computer software program to analyze these things, to cut out the noise. In other words, they were trying to look at these texts. They loaded these ancient texts onto this program, and they are able, using, you know, the most sophisticated, you know, data analytics, to be able to find what are the things that were encrypted into those texts intentionally and what's just random noise. With any of these things, if you don't know what you're doing, you can deceive yourself or fool yourself by thinking there are codes and things there. If you don't understand the principles, the mathematical statistical principles of cryptography, if you don't understand, you know, the way these things work. But the most amazing thing that's come out of all of this is that the encryptions have identified specific locations on the Earth right now where we have gone to and uncovered, you know, it indicated places like particularly in southern Spain where things were supposed to be hidden. We went to those locations and found the objects hidden there. We took high resolution photography. These things have never been seen in history at all by anyone that we know of, not in the modern era. And those are published, you know, in the book. And one thing leads to another. We go to another location that's indicated. We uncover something there.
So this is like national treasure. Right. Each clue seems to unfold a whole new series of clues, and you're exactly able to continue to follow that key to get to the treasure.
Yes. As sensational as that might seem, this is exactly what it is. And that's why the production companies and everything have been so interested in doing a documentary. They'll just be following me around. I mean, they've only purchased the unscripted documentary rights to follow me around as we go forward and guerrilla film and just go with me to just be looking over my shoulder as we're doing all of this.
Have you ever kicked over one of these rocks that it pointed you to, and when you get there, you have that Geraldo Al Capone crypt moment where there's nothing there?
Of course. I mean, well, every time we've gone to a location that's been indicated by the encryptions in the text, we have uncovered something. We've never been to a location that was indicated by the text that we did not uncover something. Now, some of the places are a little bit tricky to have access to, and we have to negotiate access either with the Israeli Antiquities Authority, or in one case, we had to negotiate with the Spanish royal family directly. And we had a liaison, a good friend of the family, who had to negotiate our access to the location. And they finally, once they saw and we had time to show them, yes, this is a serious thing, they gave us access. And it's just mind-blowing. And then when we found – and they were excited about it too, because they didn't know what was there either. And, of course, we shared everything back with them. This is one of those kind of one thing just keeps leading to another.
I'm just going to throw something out there just to kind of hook, because I've got a lot of listeners that have been sending me emails regarding a different topic that we do on the show, but it seems to be tied into this. Are you familiar with the Mandela effect?
No.
Okay. Mandela effect are these false memories people seem to recall en masse, right? And now there is
under hypnosis. Even sometimes these false memories sometimes occur, like they can be dragged out of people under hypnosis.
No, it's more like the sign. It's like, okay, as an easy example, many of us remember the Berenstain Bears, but you look it up and it's the Berenstain Bears.
Oh, okay.
You know, I remember, I know this sounds silly, but let me get into this in a second. You know, I remember Kirk Douglas dying back in the late 80s, early 90s, not just suffering a stroke, but dying, as do a lot of my listeners, remember the exact specifics as I recall them, and yet he's still alive. We know he just celebrated his 100th birthday, but there are these groupings of people that have mass memories of something that never existed. And right now, one of the strange aspects is, you mentioned earlier, that this Bible code seems to be making itself available as we are ready to receive the message. And there are there's a large sect of people out there, religious people, that are saying that their Bibles have changed, that statements and phrases that they have memorized for 20, 30 years, they're opening up their Bible and the phrase is no longer that way.
Yeah. And it could be. Yeah, it could be that they've heard a minister or somebody misquote it so many times.
No, it's the ministers I'm hearing from. That's what I'm saying, is these ministers who've studied this Bible, all of a sudden there's new version. I'm wondering, in a sense, is this effect taking place? Is the dial on the Little Orphan Annie decoder ring switching, and now the messages are becoming relevant? Because we're at that point where now we can really understand it. I'm just, and again, throwing this out there because I've had so many listeners shoot me these emails regarding, are you aware of the changes in the Bible that people are noticing and so on and so forth. It's just, a weird rabbit hole to go down, but it's kind of following in the same vein of what you're saying, that these scriptures and these words are suddenly, there's a different context to them, making them understandable. So maybe for those of us that aren't good at cracking the code, the words are shifting. The perception is, you know, and you said, I don't remember if you said this off air or on air, but that you're getting these messages from another reality, another universe or parallel, you want to say.
Right. Yeah. The reason we say that is because the messages during the key code, there was information that was absolutely precognitive. In other words, you know, we know when we know at least at the most conservative estimate of when the text was written. And yet there's information in the text that having to do with locations and situations in the 20th century. So, in other words, this is precognitive information that could not have been known by a mortal at the time. So that the information seems to be coming from a perspective outside of normal linear time. It's coming from timelessness or from eternity or however you might want to describe that. It is not coming from an intelligence that his perspective is in normal linear classical time. It's coming from a perspective of an intelligence who does not exist in that kind of a time or in timelessness. I don't know how else to describe it.
All right.
So technically they just say precognitive.
So great. You're finding this, you're not only finding the codes, you're cracking them, you're following it. And again, you mentioned the fact that you have to know what you're doing. We interviewed a guy not long ago who was into the Bible codes. And I said, how do you know you're not forcing the message? And I said, you know, knowing this, if I told you to go look for Donald Trump and chocolate milkshakes, could you find it? And he plugged it into his little algorithm. Remember that, Tim? And he came up with Trump's name and milkshake. So I'm like, so you can find whatever.
It's all noise.
Right. Are you finding
it's all complete noise.
What you want to find in this? Mm-hmm. How do you differentiate that between a real message and And these noise messages that are out there?
That's an excellent question. That's probably the best
question. I
knew
I'd get to one eventually. Good.
Yeah, that's a really good one. Do you remember the movie and based on the book Contact? So Jodie Foster plays, the book was written by Carl Sagan. She's sitting, listening to the big arrays, and she gets an equidistant audio signal they finally, for the first time, they have contact from an extraterrestrial source outside of Earth, from another galaxy. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but the premise is that they absolutely, and they do, this is actually based on a reality of astrophysicists and astronomers, they know What is a signal that is non-local and absolutely intelligent? And unfortunately, there's some people that dabble in this sort of stuff who have no clue, and they either don't have access to the sort of software. We have access now to software that absolutely eliminates the random noise. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about encryptions that may that are perfect sequences, perfect mathematical sequences of 25 letters, 30, 40 letters. Trump, in Hebrew, the name Trump is only like four letters or five letters. And, you know, milkshake, these things are there. It's probably Trump is probably encrypted into the text at some equidistance or some mathematical sequence 1,000 times. And it doesn't mean anything. It's just like random noise, you know, that emanates. It's absolutely meaningless. There is a known way that scientists and communication experts know how to uncover intelligent communication that is embedded in encrypted computer programs and encrypted messages. They've mm-hmm. been at this a long time. And that apparently that's who has written – it's been in defense intelligence and communications people who wrote the – it's called the STAR program that does this. And it's that's that group, Ancient Text Research. And they did this to try to disprove it. They asked me to consult them when they heard about what I was doing. They asked me to turn over my notes and information, and they promised that they could show an Achilles heel and show that it was all just, again, random. I had misinterpreted it. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, they went completely the other way and got and have invested apparently a fortune in time and resources in then pursuing this.
All right. So if a lot of these books were written in some cases hundreds of years after the events that took place, right, how can they be accurate? And now, you know, again, looking at these word for word, looking at these texts, I mean, doesn't that kind of, again, I mean, it's prophesizing, obviously, right? But
right. Okay. So here, this is what the real, that's another excellent question. So the oldest, this explains why Eugene Ulrich, the foreword that Eugene Ulrich wrote, the oldest extant manuscripts of, let's for instance, where our key code is in the 30th chapter of Genesis. Mm-hmm. The oldest example that we have of this text is only 1,000 years old. Okay, so from the Middle Ages, from the early Middle Ages, let's say. And the thing is that because that text that's the Leningrad Codex is a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, even though the Jews had very strict standards on how to copy things and they understood that they had to do it the perfect letter sequence they had to get down, still it's a copy. And so we're not saying that the letter sequences are absolutely perfect. And so that one of the things this is all leading to, what we're looking for, and we know that will resolve all of these questions, is to find the very original Torah and the original contents of the Ark of the Covenant, which included the stone tablets that had the law, which is also just a letter sequence, and also the original Torah that, as the narrative says, Moses placed into the Ark of the Covenant or into the chamber next to the Ark of the Covenant. And the codes that we have deciphered pinpoint the location of that chamber, where the original chamber was that Solomon had built deep below the Holy of Holies, mm-hmm. to safely put the contents of the Holy and Holies anytime the temple should come under threat.
Tim, did you have a question as well? I wanted to make sure I give you time for that.
Yeah, just briefly here, Timothy. I want to take you back to earlier in the conversation when you were talking about these Bible codes and talking about Jesus. And I want to take you back 2,000 years, and this is basically my thought. Mm-hmm. We're coming to a point now where you're deciphering these codes, but why wasn't Jesus the one to decipher these codes, and why wasn't this all solved over 2,000 years ago? Why wasn't he the one to come down and basically say, and better yet, on a second point, why wasn't he, when he was doubted by rabbis as being the one true Messiah, why wasn't mm-hmm. he the one to take one of these codes, find one of these treasures in Israel and say, see, I know the true hidden meaning of these codes.
He did, yeah.
And prove himself to these different rabbis.
He did. in the New Testament, he clearly told his disciples. I mean, if you so when we examine the New Testament and all the statements that we have, the recording statements of Jesus, it was apparent that he was alluding to this sort of thing all the time. You can even ask questions like, why in the book of Revelations, John, he's on the island of Patmos, why did he record this thing that seemed so cryptic? You read the book of Revelations or the Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. He uses these symbols, this iconography, these experiences, and it's all so cryptic. It's hard to plain. People have been arguing about its meaning ever since we've been reading it. Why didn't he just say it clearly? He uses, a woman clothed with the sun and a dragon and all these things happen and she flees into the wilderness and all this kinds of, these things that are just seem to be purely, symbolic. Why was it spoken like that? Jesus spoke like that too. And he also, you remember the experience when he walks after he's resurrected with some of his disciples and they are stunned, amazed because they say he unraveled the scriptures to us. And at the time, you got to remember, the only scriptures were what we would call the Old Testament. And he said, for them, privately, he unraveled the scriptures for them and made them aware. And he said he unraveled them to show the things there that testified of him. And so he was doing it. He was doing it.
So you're saying, in a sense, right, like Nostradamus wrote in these weird quatrains. He would change languages. He would talk in code. But it was it basically the same reason that it was considered heretical during those times to just come out and say this? So what they did was they flowered it up into a different message. And that protected the authors. So if they were found and they read this, it would seem innocuous. It would seem very generic.
When Jesus said he was the manna come down from heaven, they wanted to throw him off the edge of a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at the dynamics of what was going on, and again, I never want to pretend that I understand and communicate to you the mind and will of God. I do not know the whys. That the people always, why did it happen this way? Why did that happen that way? Why was the creation the way it was? Why do wars happen? Why is there suffering? Why, if God is this, why did he do that? If he's supposed to be loving, why? These are big philosophical questions and theological questions that it's outside of my wheelhouse and above my pay grade. And I think, outside and above most of ours, I think what most of us are looking for in life is some guidance as to what we should do now, what we should do next, and to get our questions that we have answered specifically. But if you go back and read the New Testament, you will see all kinds of hints that this is, going on. In other words, that there's allusions to that's the way the scriptures were. And again, think about it. Christians look at scriptures like in the book of Isaiah that talk about somebody being crucified, that talk about the coming of the Messiah through the lineage of David, et cetera, et cetera. And we look back and we interpret those as obviously referring to Jesus of Nazareth. The other people look at those things and say, oh, no, that's not what they mean. So much of this is simply different people's interpretations and opinions. What is clear to some people is not clear to other people. And so much of this is ideologically driven. When people have a vested ideology and a position, they're sometimes very reluctant to change that. Even in the face of a very strong empirical evidence.
Did you have a follow-up on that, Tim? No. All right. Let's – I know time is running out on us here. As you're finding these discoveries in this code and you're breaking them down, going from point A to point B to point C as it each keeps taking you to a different location to verify and validate your findings. And you said that some they've been forthcoming to allow you to come in when you show them what they're looking to see.
Right.
Why do you believe that 2017 is this nexus point where the arc of knowledge is opening to you and to us? Why are they allowing it to come now?
Right. So this is my theory. Okay. I'm just giving this as my personal theory. Since we're dealing with issues of, let's say, philosophy on the one hand, or theology, the understanding of who the Messiah is, whose his identity truly is, and we're also dealing with what you could call actionable intelligence. In other words, we're also being given information which allows us to act. My theory is that since the actionable intelligence, the it keeps leading toward some kind of safe repository where the very earliest and ancient manuscripts and texts are believed to have been stored or protected, that there's a need right now to have the original. Now we also have the technical capability of both deciphering if there is encrypted information there, but it also may have more information directly in the narrative, because there's information that people who are seeking, who want to understand things, are need to know. Put it this way: people always talk about, you know, we're always on a need to know basis. Maybe we need to know, that's the only thing that makes sense at this point. That we're being led to something which is needed right now—a shakeup. I mean, a real cold water on the party.
All right. Now, the Bible also talks about the fact that there will be false prophets who will come forward sharing information and knowledge, which will seem on the money. How do we know that, you know, that Timothy P. Smith is not one of these bringers of the false light?
Right. You would just have to use all of the admonitions and all of the warnings about that and see if they apply to me.
Well, I do see six different heads on your shoulders, and I get that point. But you know, why you,
but
though?
I mean, again, that's a personal. Right, again, we make judgments all the time.
Sure,
you have to make that judgment about anyone who steps forward,
right?
And you know, I'm no prophet who pretend I'm not claiming to be a prophet at all. Again, I am just laying on the table for people's.
But that's what a prophet is. A prophet takes the messages and shares them with the people. It doesn't mean he has to be the one that prophesied it. It means that he is bringing forth the word of God.
Right.
And that's what you're doing. I'm not putting you on the fire here.
Yeah, I'm not making predictions. I'm not trying to say this will happen. I'm not claiming to speak with, you know, a prophet says he's speaking the words of God to the people. I'm not claiming to speak God's words to people. I'm really just – the main thing I would say is I'm trying to get people to a greater appreciation of these things which have been preserved and handed down for almost 3,000 years, these early Hebrew manuscripts, and also to get people into the sort of like the hunt and the quest for these – some of these lost manuscripts. The Aleppo Codex used to be older, was 100 years older than the Leningrad Codex. When it was smuggled from Syria to Israel, the Israeli government confiscated the Torah section, which was the oldest. Great books have been written about it, and it's intriguing. Every time one of these things pops up, they seem to be stolen or disappeared. A little fragment of these early manuscripts can be worth hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's why you have grave robbers and looters out there in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, sending their little children inside of small holes and caves to get these things. I'm really trying to part of it is attract people's attention to the intriguing wonder of these things, mm-hmm. and to really understand that they are truly marvelous documents, and that they deserve our attention, and there's so much to learn about them. And I have to admit, I'm dragging people in. I'm intentionally dragging people into my quest. It's more of a quest for me, and it's so fast. And everybody involved, like people at these production companies and the publishers and all the marketing people, they've all been dragged in. In other words, they personally have become very, very interested, and however it resonates with them, and they've been digging into other subjects, mm-hmm. and finding out different things. So that's really all I'm trying to do here.
Well, when you think about how this all came to be, and you're the person to make these discoveries,
right?
How do you answer the question, why me? Why Timothy B. or P. Smith? Why not, I don't know, Bill Gates? Why not Stephen Hawking, somebody that has the attention of the world and could say, I've done this. This is one of the most hyper-intelligent humans on the earth, and we've cracked this code. This is what we can tell you. Why do you think you were selected to do this?
I do not know. And that is an honest answer. I have no idea. Maybe it's because of my averageness. You know, maybe because I can look back and go, you know, because it caught my attention, because I had the sort of background information and it was in my wheelhouse to notice it and bring it to people's attention. But it could also be because, I'm pretty typical person. I don't know. I'm just speculating. I cannot answer that question. I have no idea whatsoever.
How breaking this whole thing down. When you're uncoding this or decoding this this manuscript and looking at these different aspects, how many things have you been able to corroborate for yourself so far out of the findings that you came across?
Right. I would say, and they're in different categories. Mm-hmm. There's ones that are, of things that are so their statistical significance is just off the charts. For instance, the key code's statistical significance or its odds against being a random occurrence are over a quintillion to one. Nobody, no scientist, no statistical mathematician, physicist who has looked at this has ever suspected that these things weren't intentional. And so I would say there's, a good maybe 15 of the of encrypted information or encrypted messages, which are the odds of them being a random occurrence, let's say, go over a billion to one or a trillion to one or something like that, to where everybody agrees, well, this is intentional. Now we can talk about how we, in other words,
okay, who's everybody agrees then? Who else are you corroborating information
with? For instance, the first person I showed these things to was the dean of engineering at Princeton at the time. Mm-hmm. He was an astrophysicist, and they had been doing experiments on Dr. Robert Jan. He had gotten funding from Lawrence Rockefeller on side projects. He was involved in the PAIR research. I don't know if you ever heard of it. So he was the first person. And then from that point on, of course, as you see the forewords written by Dr. Eugene Ulrich. And then the big hurdle was it sharing it with people, cryptologists and computer program specialists involved in defense intelligence, who are probably the world's masters at encrypting, decrypting coded information and understand how to separate the noise from the legitimate things. And so, and then when I turned my information over to that group, they've involved many other people, and I don't know who all of them are. Like everyone that they've turned him over to, but they just reported back to me and gave me the kind of report on which ones. And, there were some different, ones mentioned that they said, well, that one's really curious and everything, but it doesn't have the same statistical significance as these messages. And so we tend to concentrate on the ones that are the most phenomenal.
All right. And breaking these down, looking at it, are there a few points that you can give us of what these codes are telling you? What are a couple of the key elements? Are we being told in this book that, here's an end date for it all? Here is the date Christ will return. Here is the date that, anything like that, which so many people have been seeking in the Bible code forever.
Right. This is not fortune telling. And this was the biggest mistake, I think, and the biggest problem with some of the earlier things that were published about any kind of codes in the Bible. They put them forth as being able to predict future events. What we've looked at is that is impossible, that there are so many variations in human agency and in possible potentials that these codes do not predict the future. Mm-hmm. They only, like I said, they give information about a particular geographic location. They give information. Again, there's detailed information about the virgin birth, the life, the teachings, the trial, the crucifixion, the resurrection. It's information. And then again about specific locations, but it does not. I would never pretend to be able to tell you anything predicting an exact future event. Mm-hmm. Decrypting these codes, that's fortune telling. It's a craft.
Okay.
Divination.
Well, I know Scott Walter from America Unearthed has been out in public on quite a few occasions and made claims like the fact that he knows that where the final resting place of the Ark of the Covenant is because of his connections and such. And he said these in public spots, you know, in public talks. And, you know, that like the Ark of the Covenant is stored here in the United States somewhere. And he knows the specifics of that because of the organization he's a part of and affiliated with. When you start looking into this, I mean, do you see these claims and say, yeah, he's on to something, or no, he's on something?
Yeah, I don't want to. I want to be careful about making a judgment about anyone else's, you know, research.
Sure.
Or, you know, or opinion like that. And so, again, the proof is in the pudding with, mm-hmm. with any of these things. If somebody's out there saying they know the location of the Ark of the Covenant or of any kind of, you know, something that's been hidden somewhere, they need to publish. They need to, you know, if they're interested in sharing that with anybody, they need to share it. In other words, you know, it's one thing to make the claim. It's another thing to put it on the table.
All right. We've only got a few minutes left together. With the book, what are you really hoping to do? I know you wanted to bring people into this journey with you and, mm-hmm. and involve them, which I am. I'm fascinated by this, and I'm halfway through your book. Absolutely love it. I find it fascinating, as does Amy, our booker. She was the one that was really lit up about this and said this is a lot of real game changers in this book. Right. What do you really want people to get from this?
Well, I guess the single biggest thing, and I'm probably just repeating myself, is an appreciation for these early biblical manuscripts and to understand that the original tradition may indeed be correct, that these things, that it was the, you know, the words of God that were given sometime in you know, the time of a Moses, you know, character in that part of the world. Something incredible happened at that time, right in, you know, around Egypt, the Sinai Peninsula, and we've picked up all kinds of incredible things seem to just burst open. We have signs of it in archaeology and in early studies, you know, that something incredible happened at that time. So, and also, I certainly want people to right off the bat, there is such a detailed testimony of the divinity and the of the, you know, of the messiahship of Jesus Christ in here. And I for anybody who's ever wondered, was that just something that was created by a group of people 2,000 years ago as a new cult, a new religion, and everything? I think the evidence that you will see in this book will absolutely verify to you that they could not have, that this was something that was being communicated from the heavens, you could say, or from a divine source from the very beginning. You know, probably, you know, 1500 years before Jesus was born.
Do you believe, in your own opinion, do you believe that we're getting this information from a divine source like God, the supernatural being we've always believed in? Or do you believe that we're getting it from a parallel universe, another reality that's coming through and giving us the understanding of where we originated from?
Well, the only context we have is the narrative that's in the open text of the Bible as we see it. And it doesn't make any sense that the encrypted messages would be in conflict with the overtext. In fact, all of the encryptions that we have deciphered are not only do they reinforce the themes of the text itself, they are actually embedded in those exact locations. For instance, if it's the location of them, they are perfectly synchronized, not just thematically, but in their placement. No, I mean, my personal belief, you asked me my personal belief, is this information is coming from a heavenly father, from Christ himself. In fact, the key code indicates that Jesus is God, that he is God the Father, just like he said he was.
Hmm. All right, great. Well, this has been fascinating. And please, when the documentary comes out, we'd love to hear more. And we'll be following along with your journey and see what it is that you uncover. And hopefully you get more than Al Capone's vaults got for Geraldo.
Yeah, the big empty.
Right. All right. Well, I appreciate it. And folks, if you're intrigued by what you've heard on the show tonight, there's even more with Timothy P. Smith. He's going to be on with George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM tonight. So you can make sure to check out coasttocoastam.com/stations so you can find stations and times in your area and hear George's take on this interesting topic. And I'm sure George will take you into different directions than I did because we, although we love the same kind of topics, we have different opinions on how this breaks down. So make sure you check it out tonight for more with George Norrie and Timothy P. Smith. Tomorrow we're back. Andrew Bishago, the time traveler. Yes, I said that. Time traveler is going to be back with us, Tim. And he's got some intriguing insights he thinks is going to shake up our paradigm.
I'm looking forward to it.
So yeah. We're going to talk with him tomorrow on the show. Friday, Ursula Bielski is with us. The Ghost in You, Poltergeists, Electrokinesis, and Phantasms of the Living, plus a brand new Theater of the Mind. And if that's not enough for you people, I'm going to be here Saturday night on Coast to Coast AM. I'll be hosting 4 hours Saturday night from midnight till 4 a.m. Central Time. And again, you can find more information in stations and times in your area by going to coasttocoastam.com/stations, or even better yet, we record the show and do the show live on Coast to Coast AM right here from KNSIRadio.com in St. Cloud, Minnesota, our home for Coast to Coast AM and the amazing home. They allow us to do all of our recording here for Beyond the Darkness. So check it out. Listen, you can download the app, and that way you can listen to Coast AM from anywhere by downloading the KNSI Radio app. And again, that's KNSIRadio.com to keep up with all of that. We want to thank our sponsors this evening. Again, True Car, who's been a fantastic sponsor with us. So next time you're in the market to buy a new used car, check out True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Also, we want to welcome to the show Casper, the mattress company, who is a new sponsor on our show. And to get $50 towards any mattress purchase that you want by visiting CasperTrial.com/darkness, and then use the promo code 50SLEEP, and you'll be able to save $50 towards the purchase of any mattress by, again, visiting CasperTrial.com/darkness and using promo code 50SLEEP. And to our buddies over at HelloFresh, again, get $35 off your first week of deliveries. Visit HelloFresh.com and enter the coupon code DARKNESS when you subscribe, and you'll save $35 off that very first purchase. Thank you to Timothy P. Smith. The book is available today, The Chamberlain Key, Unlocking the God Code to Reveal Divine Messages Hidden in the Bible. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.